Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am, in this audio, going to cover Exodus chapter 32, verses 1 through 35, the story of the golden calf, the idolatry of the golden calf. Our context is this. Moses is just about getting ready to come down from Mount Sinai, where he spent 40 days and 40 nights up there receiving instructions on how to build the tabernacle. In our last chapter, chapter 31, Moses has been told who to appoint as the master craftsman in charge of building the tabernacle, namely Oholiab ben Bezalel, and also the famous Sabbath day ordinance was created. And so that's the good news. Now we got some bad news here in chapter 32. We start with verse 1. Now when the people saw that Moses delayed to come down from the mountain, the people assembled about Aaron and said to him, "Come, make us a god who will go before us. As far as this Moses, the man who brought us up from the land of Egypt, we do not know what has become of him." Now it says when the people saw, that was probably be the tribal and the clan leaders, as the NIV Study Bible says, not 600,000 people, not 600,000 men that came out of Egypt. So the leaders saw that Moses had delayed to come down the mountain. 40 days and 40 nights he had been up there. Exodus 24:18 tells us that. 40 days and 40 nights. Well, what's happened to Aaron? What's happened to Moses? So the people assembled about Aaron. Now, why was Aaron there? Aaron and Hur had been left behind below Mount Sinai in order to judge the people while Moses was up on top of the mountain. We read that in Exodus 24, verses 13 through 14. So Moses arose with his assistant Joshua and went up the mountain of God. He told the elders, "Wait here for us until we return to you. Aaron and Hur are here with you. Whoever has a dispute should go to them." So Aaron and Hur were left. This is after the covenant had been confirmed with the sprinkling of the book of the covenant, sprinkling of the blood on the book of the covenant. Aaron and Hur were left behind to take care of business while Joshua and Moses went up the mountain. Joshua goes up, doesn't go all the way to the top, but Moses stops somewhere before the summit, and Moses goes all the way up to the top. So Aaron's left behind, and he does a wonderful job. This is why managers a lot of times hate to delegate to their subordinates. So the people said, "Make a god who will go before us." The god there is plural. The NIV, in fact, says gods. The NIV note says, or a god, so it could go either way. God's name, Elohim, is plural, but Elohim is how you say God in the singular, so it's a little bit ambiguous as to what the people were wanting here. Do they want to make gods, or do they want to make a god? I'm assuming a god. Why did the people want to do that? They probably wondered why Moses had disappeared. Where is he? They wanted something visible to comfort them as to God's presence. Now, Gill and Jameson Fawcett and Brown say they don't really want a brand new god. They just want an idol to represent Yahweh, the god they already had. So their crime, their sin, was not violation of the first commandment, which is you shall have no other gods before me, but of the second commandment, which is you shall not make any idols. Here's what John Gill says, quote, "Not that they were so very stupid to think that anything that could be made with hands was really God, or even could have life and breath and the power of self-motion or of walking before them, but that something should be made as a symbol and representation of the divine being carried before them, for the cloud which had hitherto gone before them from their coming out of Egypt, that had not moved from its place for 40 days or more, and seemed to them to be fixed on the mount and would not depart from it, and therefore they wanted something in the room of it as a token of the divine presence with them." So Moses has disappeared. The cloud has stuck up there on top of the mountain. They say, "Well, we're stuck here in the wilderness. Nothing's going on. We need an idol to lead us." Same God, Yahweh, but represented by a golden calf. Jameson Fawcett Brown says, quote, "The Hebrew word rendered gods, plural, is simply the name of God in its plural form. The image made was single, and therefore it would be imputing to the Israelites a greater sin than they were guilty of to charge them with renouncing the worship of the true God for idols. They meant the calf to be an image, a visible sign or symbol of Jehovah, Yahweh, so that their sin consisted not in a breach of the first commandment, but of the second commandment," as I've said earlier. And I think that's reasonable, but I must point out, the sin was enough that God put a plague on them, had 3,000 of them killed. He was pretty upset about it. So whether it's the first or second commandment they were breaking, they were still in gross sin. Adam Clark says that Aaron did not contemplate replacing the worship of Jehovah because, as we'll see in verses 5 through 7 of this chapter, Aaron proclaimed a feast for Yahweh with proper burnt and peace offerings. Verse 5, And 6, now when Aaron saw this, he built an altar before it, before the golden calf. And Aaron made a proclamation and said, tomorrow shall be a feast to the Lord. So the next day they rose early and offered burnt offerings and brought peace offerings. This sort of reminds me of the golden calf worship in the northern tribe of Israel. They were still worshiping Yahweh, but they were worshiping him under the form of golden bulls, if I remember correctly. So from all this, this is what I take out of it. Sometimes I wonder if syncretizers are not worse than outright idolaters, or if syncretizers are actually worse than outright idolaters, because they make it look so good. Oh, we still love God. We're just doing it our way. How many times do we know people who do that? I just talked to somebody that I had led to the Lord 3 years ago, and she says, well, I just don't believe in doing it the way other people do. I still pray every morning and night, but I don't believe in going to church, and I don't believe in talking to other people about God. I do it my way. Yeah, right. Now, notice in verse 1 that the people said to Aaron, as for this Moses, sort of dismissive, is it not? As for this Moses, in ASB and Holman Christian Study Bible, both say this Moses. As for this Moses, the man who brought us up, we don't know what has become of him. That's sort of dismissive of their leader. Now, the people admit that Moses had brought them out of Egypt, which was an incredible thing, out of slavery, through the Red Sea, through the wilderness, through lack of water, through lack of bread. Miracles happen. Water happened. Manna happened. Moses had done all that for him. And this is the first thing. Ah, oh, he's up there a little bit too long, 40 days and 40 nights. I think we're going to worship. We're going to make us a golden calf. Jameson Fossum Brown says, quote, the incidents related in this chapter disclose a state of popular sentiment and feeling among the Israelites that stands in singular contrast to the tone of profound and humble reverence they displayed at the giving of the law. Within a space of little more than 30 days, their impressions were dissipated. Although they were still encamped upon ground, which they had every reason to regard as holy, although the cloud of glory that capped the summit of Sinai was still before their eyes, affording a visible demonstration of their being in close contact, or rather in the immediate presence of God, they acted as if they had entirely forgotten the impressive scenes of which they had been so recently the witnesses. Exodus 24:7. This shows what the people just before Moses went back up on the mountain for 40 days. Moses had come down off the mountain. He went up and down that mountain, people dispute, 7 or 8 times, up and down. One of the times he came down, he took the covenant scroll and read it aloud to the people, and they responded, we will do and obey all that the Lord has commanded. Yeah, right. That didn't last long, did it? Now, what did the people think had become of Moses? They might have thought he had died from not eating for 40 days and 40 nights. Actually, 40 days and 40 nights is an estimate of how long he was gone, because we don't know precisely how long that was, according to Adam Clark, because fashioning the golden calf would take some time. And Clark says that they might have been working on that calf a couple of days. Might have taken Moses a couple of days to come down off the mountain. I don't know. It doesn't matter. The point is that people might have thought, well, maybe he did. Maybe we heard that. Of course, I don't know how they would have known he was fasting. Maybe he told Joshua and Aaron and Hur, maybe Aaron and Hur told him, I don't know, but anyway, the people were wondering where he was. Gill and Jameson Fawcett and Brown suggested speculation. Maybe they thought that Moses was burnt up in the flame of fire, which is on the mountaintop, Shekinah glory. Moses got toasted. Jameson Fawcett and Brown suggests maybe the people thought that Moses had lost his way in the darkness. Remember, there was a dark cloud over the mountain. Well, this not knowing what happened to Moses was quoted by Stephen in Acts 7:40. Stephen says, referring to his ancestors, the Jews' ancestors, they told Aaron, make us gods who will go before us. As for this Moses who brought us out of the land of Egypt, we don't know what's happened to him. We go now to Exodus 32, verses 2 through 4. Aaron said to them, tear off the gold rings which are in the ears of your wives, your sons, and your daughters, and bring them to me. Then all the people tore off the gold rings which were in their ears and brought them to Aaron. He took this from their hand and fashioned it with a graving tool and made it into a molten calf. And they said, this is your God, O Israel, who brought you up from the land of Egypt. Now, Aaron is in charge of all this. Yeah, I said earlier, he certainly did a great job of leading the people for Moses, didn't he? Moses leaves him in charge, and this is what's happened. At the first hint of rebellion, he meekly goes along with it. Now, some people try to defend Aaron a little bit. They say, well, you know, the people were so determined to create an idol that he really had no choice. I don't buy that. He could have said, no, I'm not going to go along with this. Now, they could have overpowered him. They might have even could have killed him, but still, he could have said no. Some people say that Aaron told the people to gather the earrings because that would take time to gather the earrings. And then, of course, they would have to fashion the calf. And all this would be timed so that Moses would come back. Jamison Foster Brown even suggests that Aaron took their earrings thinking that the people would say, no, we're not going to build a calf now. You're taking our earrings. Oh, that's our golden stuff. Well, you know, everybody's got to have a defendant. You know, O.J. Simpson had a good defense lawyer when he was tried for the murder he allegedly didn't commit. And so people have tried to defend Aaron. I don't think so. I think that he should have washed his hands of the whole affair. But instead of doing that, he helped the Israelites collect the necessary gold. Now, where did these gold rings come from? Well, they were probably part of the plunder brought from Egypt. It's interesting that that incident of plundering the Egyptians is mentioned three times in Exodus, which I didn't realize until just recently. Exodus 3, 21 through 22, I will grant this people favor in the sight of the Egyptians, and it shall be that when you go, you will not go empty-handed, but every woman shall ask of her neighbor and the woman who lives in her house articles of silver and articles of gold and clothing, and you will put them on your sons and daughters. Thus you will plunder the Egyptians. That's really plunder in air quotes, because they didn't actually steal the silver and gold. It was given to them. Exodus 11, 2 through 3, first part of the verse. Speak now in the hearing of the people that each man asks from his neighbor and each woman from her neighbor for articles of silver and gold. Exodus 3 mentions the women. Exodus 11 says the men and the women. The Lord gave the people favor because they got the gold. Exodus 12, 35 and 36 verses. Now the sons of Israel had done according to the word of Moses, for they had requested from the Egyptians articles of silver and gold and clothing, and the Lord had given the people favor in the sight of the Egyptians, so that they let them have their request. Thus they plundered the Egyptians. So God miraculously gives them with gold, which they were supposed to use to build the tabernacle. Instead of doing that, they turn it into an idol. Adam Clark says, their love of idolatry trumped even their love for ostentation in dress. Well, the people didn't use all their gold on this golden calf, because later they contributed the gold to build the tabernacle. We see that in Exodus 36, verses 3 through 7. They received from Moses all the contributions which the sons of Israel had brought to perform the work and the construction of the sanctuary. Let me drop down a little bit. The people are bringing much more. The skillful men, the workmen, said to Moses, the people are bringing much more than enough for the construction work. So Moses issued commands, hey, don't bring any more. Thus the people were restrained from bringing any more. So obviously they had plenty of gold from the Egyptians. They didn't use it all in that golden calf. Now, did the people later melt the calf down and reuse the gold in the tabernacle? No. We read in verse 20 in our chapter here, Exodus 32, he, Moses, took the calf they had made, burned it up, and ground it to powder. He scattered the powder over the surface of the water and forced the Israelites to drink the water. So no, there was no gold, the golden calf, in the tabernacle. Now, the earrings were said to be taken from the women, but also the sons. Take the earrings which are in the ears of your wives and your daughters and your sons. Verse 2. Now, some people have done some interesting logic here and said, okay, this proves that foreign slaves started the insurrection. Remember, there was a mixed rabble. I don't have the quote right now, but a mixed rabble came up with the Israelites on the Exodus. It wasn't just Jews. And here's how the reasoning goes. The fact that the sons had earrings shows that men wore earrings. But, as Jameson Fawcett Brown says, Egyptian men did not wear earrings. So the men who were wearing earrings must have been these foreign slaves who were the mixed rabble who came up and who led their insurrection against Yahweh. Foreign slaves led the golden calf incident. I don't know. I think that's possible, but I don't think it's very likely. I think that's a little bit of a stretch. Now, how was this golden calf fashioned? The NIV Study Bible says it was gold plating over a carved wooden calf. The fact that the calf was later burned, as we'll see in verse 20, supports this, because you can burn wood. It's hard to burn. You don't really burn gold. You melt it maybe, but you don't burn it. And verse 20 says it was burned, so I think that's probably true. Another option is that the golden calf was crudely cast in gold and then later shaped with a tool, and then the gold was later melted down. I don't think so. I think the NIV Study Bible is right. Gold plating over a carved wooden calf, I think, is the way I'm going to go with that. Now, of course, making this golden calf was a flagrant violation of the second commandment, which says, Exodus 20, verse 2, I am the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the place of slavery. Now, this commandment had already been told by the people. Remember, Moses went up and down the mountain. So Exodus 19:25, he had come down from the mountain in 19:25. So Moses went down to the people and told them. He told them the Ten Commandments. This is before they were written down on stone, of course. Many people say that calf, in other words, the reason I'm saying that is that people had no excuse. Well, we didn't know. Yeah, they did know. Some say the golden calf was modeled after the Egyptian god Apis, the chief deity of the Egyptians. And I'm not surprised because old Apis shows up over and over and over again in Egyptian history. Who was that Persian emperor? Was it Cambyses? He was he had conquered Egypt and he decided to go up and slaughter the sacred bull of the Egyptians. Bad career move. Not exactly designed to make your subjects appreciate you as their colonial ruler. Now here's a little interesting translation issue. Verse 4 says, I'm reading the NASB, this is your God, your little g God, O Israel, who brought you up from the land of Egypt. This is what the people said to the golden calf. This is your little g God, O Israel. The Holman Christian Study Bible note at that point, on verse 4, has two alternate ways to translate it. Israel, this is your God, little g, that's the way the NASB does it, or Israel, this is your God, capital G. Again, that would go to the issue of were the Israelites looking for another God beside Yahweh? In this case, it would be this is your little g God, O Israel. Or if they still want to worship Yahweh, in English we'll say this is your capital G God, O Israel. The people are saying to their fellow Israelites, this is your Yahweh God. This is your capital G God, O Israel, who brought you up from the land of Egypt. They're still believing in God. They're just making an idol to him. It's interesting that Jeroboam, who set up the golden calf idol in northern Israel, in 1 Kings 12:28-29 says this, so the king consulted and made two golden calves, and he said to them, it is too much for you to go to Jerusalem. Behold your gods, O Israel, that brought you up from the land of Egypt. Interesting, he uses the same expression setting up his golden calf, or his golden calves, in his case. He uses the same expression that the people of Israel use when they call their fellow Israelites to worship the golden calf, the God who brought you up from the land of Egypt. We go to now Exodus 32, verses 5 through 6. Now when Aaron saw this, he built an altar before it, and Aaron made a proclamation and said, tomorrow shall be a feast to the Lord. So the next day they rose early and offered burnt offerings and brought peace offerings, and the people sat down to eat and to drink and rose up to play. Now Aaron probably recognized the idolatrous consequences of the calf because he put an altar before it and put it was a legal altar because he had legal burnt and peace offerings, which of course were not established yet by the law, but they had burnt offerings and peace offerings before the law. The law just codified their custom. Now Aaron tells the people, tomorrow shall be a feast to the Lord. Some say that Aaron here is trying to buy some time, hoping Moses would show up before then. The NIV Study Bible suggests this. And notice that Aaron says, tomorrow shall be a feast to the Lord. That's capital L-O-R-D, Yahweh. This seems to confirm the view that the people had not renounced the worship of Yahweh, rather they were worshiping Yahweh in an idolatrous fashion, according to Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown. Because Aaron didn't say, tomorrow shall be a feast to the golden calf. He says, Yahweh. Verse 6 says, so the next day they rose early and offered burnt offerings on the morrow. John Gill says, the people were eager to sacrifice to their new idol. Oh, they're excited. We got a new God. And so, in connection with this idolatrous worship, they had burnt offerings, they had peace offerings, and the people sat down to eat and to drink and rose up to play. So this was not solemn worship. This was boisterous, festive worship. Rose up to play, the NIV Study Bible translates as indulge in revelry. The NIV Study Bible says this was the typical practice of pagan idolatrous feast. Get drunk, have a good time, dance around. This is quoted by Paul in 1 Corinthians 10:7. Do not be idolaters, as some of them were, as it is written, the people sat down to eat and drink and stood up to play. Isn't it interesting? Idolatry is usually connected with excess, fleshly excess, gluttony, sex. In fact, the word play, the Hebrew word that's translated play, often has sexual connotations. Let's look at Genesis 26:8. It came about when he'd been there a long time that Abimelech, king of the Philistines, looked out through a window and saw, behold, Isaac was caressing his wife Rebekah. Of course, Isaac had told Abimelech that Rebekah was his sister, and you don't do that kind of stuff. You don't caress your sister like that. And so Abimelech says, whoa, Isaac. Abimelech was king of Gerar, right there in the southwest of Israel. south of the Philistines, and this is what he saw. And that word there, I think the King James has he was sporting with his wife, which sounds like play, sport, play, sex. You know, it's close. And so there could have been some sexual no-nos going on here in this idolatrous revelry. Adam Clark says there may have been somewhat of an orgy here. In the NIV Study Bible says immoral orgies frequently accompanied pagan worship in ancient times. Now the people were eating at this feast in verse 6. Adam Clark says they were eating the part of the peace offerings which were reserved for the people, which he says is the breast. I couldn't find the site. I know that the breast was for the, in the Levitical system, the breast was offered to the priesthood, all the priests, and the right thigh was given to the officiating priest who slaughtered the peace offering. I couldn't find who, what part of the animal belonged to the people. But anyway, that was a common thing. Peace offerings were shared between the priest and the people. We go now to Exodus 32, verses 7 through 10. Then the Lord spoke to Moses, "Go down at once, for your people, whom you brought up from the land of Egypt, have corrupted themselves. They have quickly turned aside from the way which I commanded them. They have made for themselves a molten calf, and have worshipped it, and have sacrificed to it, and said, 'This is your God, O Israel, who brought you up from the land of Egypt.' The Lord said to Moses, 'I have seen this people, and behold, they are an obstinate people. Now then let me alone, that my anger may burn against them, and that I may destroy them, and I will make of you a great nation.'" So God tells Moses to get down on the double quick. Go down at once. So the idolatry had gone on a day before the Lord warned Moses, and then God says, get down there. Now you wonder why God didn't just say, "Moses, get down there quick, so you can stop this nonsense before it gets out of hand," or even told him to get down there before the golden calf was even made. Well, John Gill says that God let the idolatry play out pretty far, and I wonder why. To reveal what was in their hearts? I think so. So that we can all see what's in the human heart. That's why God gives us free will, right? He gives the human race free will, and what do we do with it? It's despicable and disgraceful what the human race does with its free will. But free will is a part of God's plan. There's no justice without free will. And so God says, okay, we're going to show to the world, even to this day, which is what, 3 millennia later, we still know what happened at this feast of the golden calf and the sin of the people, the sin of idolatry. God made an object lesson out of this thing. That's why he didn't tell Moses to get down there quicker, in my humble opinion. Now notice the pronouns that God uses. In verse 7, he says to Moses, "Go down at once, for your people, Moses, your people." And then verse 9, he says to Moses, "I have seen this people." So he calls the people, God calls the people, your people and this people. He doesn't call them my people. Exodus 3:10, he did. "Therefore, come now, I will send you to Pharaoh so that you may bring my people." God says to Moses, "You may bring my people, the sons of Israel, out of Egypt." He's changed the pronouns now because they had broken the covenant and they were no longer his people. Verse 8, God says to Moses, "They, the people, have quickly turned aside from the way which I committed them." This is after pious promises were made just 40 days before. We'll see this pious promise in Exodus 24:3. "Then Moses came and recounted to the people all the words of the Lord and his ordinances." This is before the 40-day stint up on Mount Sinai when God had spoken to Moses and he went down and told the people, he told Moses the Ten Commandments orally, and he went down there and said, "Hey, you're going to follow?" And all the people answered with one voice and said, "All the words which the Lord has spoken, we will do." Yeah, right. It shows how fickle people are. Now, the people were said to worship the golden calf. God tells Moses they've worshipped it. How did they worship it? Well, here's some options from John Gill. They could have bowed the knee to the calf, their knees to the calf. They could have kissed the calf. They could have kissed their hands as they approached the calf, and I assume they then laid the hands on the calf. But however they did it, they did it. And then God says to Moses, verse 9, "I have seen this people, and behold, they are an obstinate people." The NIV says they are a stiff-necked people, like a horse or an oxen that you can't get to turn. As the NIV Study Bible says, I had a horse one time, his name Mr. Perfect. His nickname was Mr. Perfect Ass because he was stiff-necked. He was stubborn. You ride that horse and try to get him to go to the left, he would want to go to the right. His neck would not turn in the way that he should go. So the people were like that, obstinate and stiff-necked. In verse 10, God says, "Now then, let me alone." He says to Moses, "Let me alone, Moses." Now what does he mean by "let me alone"? Don't bother me with prayer for these people. I've had it, so that my anger may burn against them, that I may destroy them. Well, he didn't destroy them. which shows his grace. We'll see later in the next verse, Moses didn't pay any attention to that and prayed for him anyway, prayed for the people anyway. He did bother God about that. Notice at the end of the verse here, verse 10, he says, God says to Moses, I will make of you a great nation. In other words, Abraham's promise is going to be carried out, but not by these golden calf worshipers down here. I'm going to just start over with you. Might take a while, might take another millennia or two to get a new people going, a new people of God going, but I'm going to make of you a great nation. You're going to be the new Abraham. Note that Moses didn't want to be the head of a great nation because he immediately began to pray for the people in the next verse. This is John Gill's note. Even though God said to leave him alone, Moses says, I'm going to pray. I'm going to ask you, God. Let's read that now in Exodus 32, 11 through 14. Then Moses entreated the Lord his God and said, O Lord, why does your anger burn against your people whom you have brought out from the land of Egypt with great power and with a mighty hand? Why should the Egyptians speak, saying, What evil intent he brought them out to kill them in the mountains and to destroy them from the face of the earth? Turn from your burning anger and change your mind about doing harm to your people. Remember Abraham, Isaac, and Israel, your servants to whom you swore by yourself, and said to them, I will multiply your descendants as the stars of the heavens, and all the land of which I have spoken I will give to your descendants, and they shall inherit it forever. So the Lord changed his mind about the harm which he said he would do to his people. I guess the Lord changed his mind because this was a bodacious prayer that Moses came up with. First of all, in verse 11, he calls the people your people. O Lord, why does your anger burn against your people? God had said, Moses, they're your people. And Moses turns around and says, no, God, they're your people. Moses, this is pretty cheeky if you ask me. You're speaking to God face to face. God says, don't pray. Leave me alone. I'm finished. But Moses went right back and said, no, God, please, please. Moses used three arguments to try to save the people of Israel. Argument number one, the people belong to God. As I just said that, they're your people. Argument number two, the Egyptians will mock God if Israel is destroyed. God's reputation would be harmed if he destroys the people. I don't think God worries about that too much. I mean, God's reputation is harmed when these preachers shack up and fornicate with their secretaries. This kind of stuff happens all the time. God judges that. And it does cause a reproach to fall on the people of God and on God's name himself. But God still judges anyway, and he still punishes anyway. But that was the second argument that Moses used. The third argument, and this is the best one, the most forcible argument, in John Gill's opinion and mine too, Moses appeals to the covenant promises made to Abraham. He says to Moses, he says to God, God, you swore by yourself and said, I will multiply your descendants to the stars of heaven. That's, of course, referring to the famous promise of offspring made in Genesis 15 at the covenant. All right, here's another point here, starting in verse 11. Moses says, don't let your anger burn against your people whom you have brought out of the land of Egypt. He gives credit to God for getting them out of Egypt. But it's interestingly, in verse 7, which we've just read, the Lord spoke to Moses, go down at once for your people you brought up from the land of Egypt have acted corruptly. So God tells Moses, you brought them up, and Moses tells God, no, you brought them up. Well, Moses is being humble here. He acknowledges that what he, Moses, had done had been God's doing. Note that there's nothing wrong with ascribing something to human beings. God says, Moses, you did it. As long as it's understood by everybody that it was God who gave Moses, who gave the individual the strength to do it. That's like when people say, oh, that was a great teaching you gave, or whatever, and the Christian that receives that praise says, no, it wasn't me, it was God. That's very humble, but nothing wrong with giving thanks to humans for doing something, even though it was God that gave them the power to do it. Now let me go and pick up something I left out here by this argument that God's reputation would be destroyed if the people of Israel were destroyed. The Egyptians will mock and say, you crossed the Red Sea, but look what happened to you. You got killed in the desert, so what was the big deal about you beating us? This idea of God's reputation being hurt comes up again in Joshua 7:9. Joshua speaking, he says, for the Canaanites and all the inhabitants of the land will hear of it, and they will surround us and cut off our name from the earth. And what will you do for your great name? In other words, if we get beat, Yahweh gets beaten. That looks bad because it looks like all the pagan nations have won. We go now to Exodus chapter 32, verses 15 and 16. Then Moses turned and went down from the mountain with the two tablets of the testimony in his hand, tablets which were written on both sides. They were written on one side and the other. The tablets were God's work, and the writing was God's writing engraved on the tablets. Moses is said to come down from the mountain here in verse 15. That's because he had been up on the mountain for 40 days and 40 nights. Exodus 24:18 says that Moses entered the midst of the cloud as he went up to the mountain, and Moses was on the mountain 40 days and 40 nights. So he's coming down the mountain. He has two tablets. Well, this was the ancient Near Eastern practice. There were duplicates of the Ten Commandments, one copy for God, one copy for the people, just as in other ancient Near Eastern treaties. One party would have one copy of the treaty, and the other party would have the other copy of the treaty. Well, since God couldn't keep his copy in heaven, he put it in the Israelites put his copy in the ark. The Israelites' copy was in the ark, too, so both copies were in the ark. Now, these two tablets were duplicates of each other. That's according to the majority view. Some people say that the two tablets meant that five commandments were on one tablet and five on the other. I don't think so. The tablets are called the tablets of the testimony. That's another way of saying the law, because the law testified to God's will for the people. Now, the tablets were written on both sides, and this is a little bit confusing because there are several ways you could look at this. John Gill gives the options. Option number one, you could have the same thing written on the front and the back of the stones. Well, let's just assume that it's two stones, one for each party. The Ten Commandments were all on one stone. So that means you would have Ten Commandments on the front of the stone and a copy of those same Ten Commandments on the back of the stone, and the same for the other stone. So the purpose of that would be so that when it was held up, it could be read by those in the front as well as those behind. Well, that's an idea. John Gill says option number two, you could have all the Ten Commandments written on one side of one tablet and all the commandments written on the other side of the other tablet, so you could put the two blank sides together and have the two tablets hooked together or clapped together like sort of like a book. Well, that wouldn't fit the idea of two duplicates copies of the Ten Commandments. It does fit the idea of both sides, but you wouldn't have two copies, one for one party and one for the other. So I don't think that's it. Or it could be the two stones were not put together in a book, but there's not enough room on one side for all the commandments, so they would put, let's say, five on one side and five on the back side. And that would be one copy, then five on one side and five on the back side. That would be the other copy, the duplicate copy. I think that probably makes more sense to me. You either had five on each side of the two duplicate stones, or you had 10 on each side of the two duplicate stones. Either way, the law was written on two sides. Now in verse 16, these tablets are said to be God's writing engraved on the tablets. We recall that the Ten Commandments were written by the finger of God in the last chapter, verse 18. When he had finished speaking with him upon Mount Sinai, he gave Moses the two tablets of the testimony, tablets of stone written by the finger of God. We go down to Exodus 32:17-18. Now when Joshua heard the sound of the people as they shouted, he said to Moses, "There is sound of war. There is a sound of war in the camp." But he said, Moses said, "It is not the sound of the cry of triumph, nor is it the sound of the cry of defeat, but the sound of singing I hear." Now Joshua, if you recall, it accompanied Moses partway up the mountain. The NIV Study Bible says, perhaps, I think he did. See, it is a little bit unclear, but Joshua, Aaron, and Ur, and Moses, when they went up, when they went down, when they ate the meal, when they separated. But I'm assuming that Joshua went part of the way up the mountain. He stopped, and Moses went by himself up to the very top. And so Moses is now meeting Joshua on the way down. And as they are going down the mountain, they hear from off in the distance all this noise. And Joshua immediately thought it was war. Why? Well, he's a general. That's what he would think. He'd be concerned about that. He's probably thinking, oh my gosh, somebody's attacked the people while I'm up here on the mountain. But Moses says, no, it's singing. Now, Moses had been tipped off by God what was going on in verses 7 through 9, if you recall. And so he was better equipped than Joshua to know what was going on. He knew that the people were playing, as the scripture says, eating and drinking and playing. So he tells Joshua, no, we got a problem here. We go down to verse 19, Exodus 32. It came about as soon as Moses came near the camp that he saw the calf and the dancing. And Moses' anger burned, and he threw the tablets from his hands and shattered them at the foot of the mountain. Now, the revelers, the idolaters, the partiers, they must have been suddenly caught up when they saw Moses. They thought he was dead. They thought he was gone. And oops, there he is. They must have gotten real quiet, probably dead quiet, as Moses looks at him and then smashes the tablets. Now, the people wouldn't know what the tablets were. but they sure would have been able to see that Moses was angry and not happy. Now, why did Moses shatter the stone tablets? Here's some options. One, to testify against Israel that they had broken the covenant, as the NIV Study Bible and Jamison, Fawcett, and Brown say. That makes sense. Option number two, Moses lost his temper, and he broke the tablets in distress and anguish of spirit. That's Adam Clark's idea. Clark defends that by saying, look, he's not chastised anywhere. Remember when he struck the rock twice and was banished from Israel? That was at the end of the journey. He was chastised for that when he lost, and a lot of people say it's because he lost his temper. John Gill says, quote, this breaking of the two tablets of stone, this was not the mere effect of passion, at least a sinful one, but was under the influence and direction of God himself, since we never read he was blamed for this action. Well, so Gill disagrees with the idea that Adam Clark had that Moses lost his temper. So Gill is saying this is righteous anger, godly anger. Adam Clark, however, says, quote, we must not excuse this act. It was rash and irreverent. God's writing should not have been treated in this way. Well, that's a close question. I'm not sure why Moses did it, godly anger or sinful anger, but he did it, and he was angry. We go to Exodus 32, verse 20. He, that's Moses, took the calf which they had made and burned it with fire and ground it to powder and scattered it over the surface of the water and made the sons of Israel drink it. Now, the calf is said to be burned here. Remember, we said the calf was either gold-plated wood or solid gold. But whatever it was totally destroyed, totally burned, so the remnants of it would hold no superstitious value, as John Gill says. The gold was ground to powder. The golden calf was ground to powder, which was a fitting and humiliating end to an idol. It's interesting that King Jeroboam's golden calf altar got the same treatment, ground to powder. How could this technically be accomplished? John Gill says, we don't know. The technology could have come from Egypt to grind up gold. Clark says, we do know. This is what he says. The gold was melted into ingots. The ingots were stamped into thin leaves, and the leaves were ground into powder. A lot of trouble, but of course, they would be glad to expend that trouble to get rid of, or Moses would, to get rid of the idol. I think the easiest way to say is that the idol was wood with gold plate hammered on it, and that's a lot easier to grind into powder, to smash it into powder. We read about this also in Deuteronomy 9:21. I took your sinful thing, this is Moses speaking, the calf which you had made, and burned it with fire and crushed it, grinding it very small until it was fine as dust, and I threw its dust into the brook that came down from the mountain. So Moses, I believe this was wood, he crushed the whole thing, smashed it, ground it up. He made the sons of Israel drink the gold powder, or the gold and wooden powder that was in the water. He made the sons of Israel drink it. That would not be all 600,000 of them, of course. There would not be enough powder to make them all drink it. But it was rather the leaders, as John Gill points out, and I'm sure correctly. I don't know what the result is of drinking wooden ash or golden powder mixed with water. I'm sure it would not taste good, and I don't know what the effect would be. I would think it'd be sort of toxic. But at any rate, that was the end of the golden calf. Poetic justice. Pretty humiliating for the leaders of the Israelites to have to drink powdered idol. We go down to verses 21 through 24 of Exodus 32. Then Moses said to Aaron, what did this people do to you that you have brought such great sin upon them? Aaron said, do not let the anger of my Lord burn. You know the people yourself that they are prone to evil. For they said to me, make a God for us who will go before us. For this Moses, the man who brought us from the land of Egypt, we do not know what has become of him. I said to them, whoever has any gold, let them tear it off. So they gave it to me, and I threw it into the fire, and out came this calf. So Moses immediately goes to Aaron, his brother. He knows that Aaron was in charge, and so that's why he wants to hold him accountable. Notice that Hur is not mentioned, because Aaron had been left with Hur to take care of the people. John Gill says it's reasonable to think that Hur was dead, because we no longer hear of him. He just disappears. So that wouldn't surprise me that Hur is Kaputsky. He could have been killed by the Israelites because he reproved them. He might have said, no golden calf. And they said, oh, yes, we're going to have a golden calf, and we're going to kill you, Hur. All speculation. Now, in verse 21, Moses said to Aaron, what did this people do to you? Here's some options as to what Moses must have thought that would have caused Aaron to do what he did. He might have thought Aaron must have been bewitched by the people to do something so stupid. Or maybe, as John Gill suggests, maybe Moses thought Aaron had been threatened to be killed by the people by standing up to them. And so he's saying, okay, what did you do? You gave in to their extortion and their threats. Or, now this is John Gill's idea and this is off the wall. It could be that Moses imagined that there was an injury, some unspecified injury the people had done to Aaron. Aaron had thus gotten ticked off. And so he says, okay, you want to do me bad? I'm going to lead you into idolatry for punishment. I don't think so. Or maybe Moses is just saying, look, Aaron, what did they do to you? How did they persuade you to do this? That's a little bit softer than being bewitched. Similar idea, actually. So Moses is trying to figure out how Aaron could have been so irresponsible, dumb, and stupid. Aaron responds very humbly. He calls Moses my Lord in verse 22. Do not let the anger of my Lord burn. Remember, this is his brother. He's calling him my Lord. But he was addressing Moses not as his brother, but as the leader of Israel. Now, verse 22, Aaron says, look, Moses, you know these people. And Aaron is trying to soften the criticism that's coming his way from Moses. He's saying, look, these people are difficult to deal with. You've had trouble with them. I had trouble with them. So how about go easy on me? Now, Moses actually did have first-hand experience about the people's murmuring and rebellion. For example, in Exodus 16, with regard to the fact that they didn't have meat in the desert before they had gotten to Mount Sinai, we read this, verse 2, Exodus 16, the entire Israelite community grumbled against Moses and Aaron in the wilderness. The Israelites said to them, if only we had died by the Lord's hand in the land of Egypt, when we sat by pots of meat and ate all the bread we wanted. Instead, you brought us into this wilderness to make this whole assembly die of hunger. So Moses has already had some blowback from the people, and so Aaron is saying, hey, you know how stiff-necked these people are? They were making a golden calf, and there wasn't anything I could do to stop them. That's what his line of defense is. Also, Moses had experienced the rebellion of the people at Rephidim when the people were grumbling because there was no water to drink. And Moses replied, why are you complaining to me? Why are you testing the Lord? That's in Exodus 17, the first three verses. The people said in verse 3 to Moses, why did you ever bring us up from Egypt to kill us and our children and our livestock with thirst? Acting like Moses deliberately tried to kill the Israelites. So yeah, they were stiff-necked, hard-hearted, and irresponsible. Aaron cites the people as saying, hey, let's make an idol because we don't know what's become of Moses. Where is he, this man? Aaron quotes that, and perhaps he did that in order to give an implied rebuke of Moses for staying so long. In other words, Aaron's saying, hey, the people were worried about what became of you, Moses. You know, Moses, if you hadn't have taken so long, I would have been able to deal with this a lot easier. But they got more and more upset. The next thing I know, they're building a golden calf and worshiping it. If you'd have come down sooner, all this trouble wouldn't have happened. So Aaron continues his defense in verse 24. Aaron tells Moses, out came this calf. I threw the gold in the fire and out came this calf. Like the fire automatically made the gold shaped like a calf, and it was just some kind of a mystical operation there. I didn't really have anything to do with fashioning this calf, which is absurd, of course. Out came this calf. Seems like Moses would have seen through that in a minute. Aaron didn't make any mention of his fashioning the calf with a tool. Now, the NIV Study Bible says that Aaron could hardly have thought that Moses would believe such an incredible story. Well, I agree with that. So the question is why did Aaron tell it to Moses if he didn't expect Moses to believe it? I think Aaron was just spinning it as fast as he could under pressure. His defense was absolutely worthless, of course. Deuteronomy 9:20 says the Lord was angry enough with Aaron to destroy him. So I, Moses, also prayed for Aaron at the same time. And John Gill says if Moses had not prayed for Aaron, God would have destroyed Aaron right there on the spot. Clark says that Aaron's defense, this thing about out came the golden calf, was, quote, Clark says, quote, what a silly and ridiculous subterfuge. Well, it really is. Exodus 32, 25 through 26. Now, when Moses saw that the people were out of control, for Aaron had let them get out of control to be a derision among their enemies, then Moses stood in the gate of the camp and said, whoever is for the Lord, come to me. And all the sons of Levi gathered together to him. Now, that phrase is translated out of control in the NASB. In the NIV, is translated running wild. So the people were running wild. The NIV Study Bible says that when people abandon God, immorality soon follows. The KJV actually has naked, that the people were naked. Here's a quote from John Gill's editor, quote, "It is quite possible the people were physically naked, having taken off all their clothes to indulge in the idolatrous worship of the calf and sexual immorality that usually is associated with such wicked practices." Jameson Fawcett Brown says, quote, "Some think they were literally naked as the Egyptians performed some of their rites in that indecent manner." Well, whether they were naked or whether they were just running around drunk, carousing, they were out of control. Moses stood in the gate of the camp and said, "Whoever's the Lord, come to me." So Moses had to stop the riotous reveling here. And this took a lot of guts to stand there and say, "Hey, whoever's for the Lord, come to me," because they could easily turn on Moses and killed him. Moses is said to stand in one of the gate. Well, he says stood in the gate of the camp. Actually, there was more than one gate. Exodus 32, verse 27, which we'll get to shortly. He told them, "This is what the Lord, the God of Israel, says. Every man fasten his sword to his side. Go back and forth through the camp from entrance to entrance," or gate to gate, "from entrance to entrance, and each of you kill his brother." Jameson Fawcett Brown says the camp probably was protected by a rampart from the attack of the Amalekites. So the camp, they probably camped with a rampart, which is a wall with something on top of it to protect from incoming weaponry. And then they had to have a gate in the wall to get inside the camp. But there was more than one gate. So Moses stood at one of those gates and made that pronunciation, "Whoever is for the Lord, come to me." That's interesting, this thing about who we're going to stand for the Lord or we're not going to stand for the Lord. Kind of had a moment of decision. We see that in several scriptures. I've got three here. Joshua 24:15. "If it is disagreeable in your sight to serve the Lord, choose for yourselves today whom you will serve, whether the gods which your fathers served, which are beyond the river," that's the Euphrates River, Haran, where Abraham's father was, grandfather, "or the gods of the Amorites in whose land you're living." Amorites, just a term for all the Canaanites. "But as for me and my house, we will serve the Lord. Choose this day whom you will serve." That's a famous verse, actually. 1 Kings 18:21. "Elijah came near to all the people and said, 'How long will you hesitate between two opinions? If the Lord is God, follow him. But if Baal, follow him.'" Now, these people did not answer him a word. So Elijah didn't get a good response there, but he gave them a choice. You're going to follow God or you're going to follow Baal. Jesus said in Matthew 6:24, "No one can serve two masters, for either he will hate the one and love the other, or he will be devoted to one and despise the other." You cannot serve God and wealth. Choose what you're going to serve. As Bob Dylan once said in a song, you got to serve somebody. Everybody serves somebody. You want to serve God, he'll bless you beyond your wildest imaginations, or you want to serve the world, and you'll get what's coming, and it won't be nice. Now, verse 26 says, "All the sons of Levi gathered together to Moses." Well, that's a generalization. And if you study Bible points out, there's another verse that implies that some of the Levites were killed in this little exercise that the Levites were going out to do. They quote Deuteronomy 33:9, who referred to the Levites, "Who said of his father and his mother, 'I did not consider them'? The Levite said of his father and his mother, 'I did not consider them,' and he did not acknowledge his brothers, nor did he regard his own sons." Now, what that's referring to, of course, is what happens in the next several verses. We'll get to this in a minute, but verse 27 says, Moses says, "I want you to kill every man his brother, every man his friend and his neighbor." That's the Levites. The Levites did that, killed 3,000 people. Well, the people that were killing were their brothers. So that means that all the sons of Israel were not gathered unto Moses. That word "all" is so misinterpreted so often. It can mean many, it can mean a lot. It does not necessarily mean all to the all without exception. It just doesn't mean that. And it's easy to check in a lexicon and you'll see that. So we can look at this, and all the sons of Levi means lots of the sons of Levi gathered to Moses. And then Moses tells them, you got to kill some of your kinfolk. Now, the NIV Study Bible says, because of this heroic deed that the Levites did here, at some stage, this is the reason that they were given the honor of serving in the tabernacle. The NIV Study Bible also says that they used to be priests, the Levites, but later on, as time went on, they were subordinated to the priests, so the Levites were no longer priests. The only people that could be priests were people in the family of Aaron. The other families of the tribe of Levi, Gershon, and so forth, they did the service in the temple. They didn't do priestly stuff anymore. They kind of were demoted, I guess, to handling the temple duties. I don't know how the NIV Study Bible knows that. It might be just a speculation on their part. At any rate, we now go to chapter 32, verses 27 through 29. He, that's Moses, said to the people of Israel, "Thus says the Lord, the God of Israel, every man of you put his sword upon his thigh." Well, actually, he said to them, meaning the sons of Levi, the Levites, "Every man of you, every Levite of you, put his sword upon his thigh and go back and forth from gate to gate of the camp and kill every man his brother," his Levite brothers, "and every man his friend and every man his neighbor." So the sons of Levi did as Moses instructed, and about 3,000 men of the people fell that day. Then Moses said, "Dedicate yourselves today to the Lord, for every man has been against his son and against his brother, in order that God may bestow a blessing upon you today." First of all, notice the punishment. The punishment was capital punishment for this idolatry. Serious business. That shows what God thought about idolatry. This event of the golden calf shows that idolatry was tantamount to the destruction of the people of Israel. And that's why God said, I'm not going to put up with that. John Gill said that this killing every man his brother explains why the number of the Levites was so small when they were numbered in the census. There were only 22,000 Levites. No other tribe was as small as 30,000. It's because the Levites had whacked some of their fellow brethren. And it makes sense that they did that, because the Levites are responsible for worship, or they were getting ready to be assigned the task of worship on Mount Sinai. And so they were probably prominent in the worship service of the golden calf. At least that's a speculation. Now, verse 27, the Levites are told to kill every man his brother. Imagine that, killing your own blood relation. That must have been an awful difficult thing for the Levites to do. Reminds me of Matthew 10:37. "He who loves father or mother more than me is not worthy of me. And he who loves son or daughter more than me is not worthy of me." Spiritual relationships with Jesus are more important even than our family relationships. Luke 14:26, "If anyone comes to me and does not hate his own father and mother and wife and children and brothers and sisters, yes, and even his own life, he cannot be my disciple." And of course, that hate there means love less. You got to love your father and mother less than you love Jesus. All right, now in verse 29, we read that Moses says, "Dedicate yourselves today to the Lord." This is when the Levites were set apart, consecrated unto the Lord to be servants. It doesn't say it explicitly, but it's a good speculation to think that. And the reason was that is because, "For every man has been against his own son and against his brother." The Holman Christian Bible translates that as, "Since each man went against his son and his brother." To kill your own sons, to kill your own brothers for the purity of the Lord, that takes a lot of chutzpah. And because of that, Moses said, "You're going to get blessed. You're going to be dedicated." And I assume that means they're going to be appointed the people in charge of the worship services, the Jewish rituals, the Levitical priesthood. Exodus 32, verses 30 through 32. "On the next day, Moses said to the people, 'You yourselves have committed a great sin, and now I'm going up to the Lord. Perhaps I can make atonement for your sin.' Then Moses returned to the Lord and said, 'Alas, this people has committed a great sin, and they have made a god of gold for themselves. But now if you will forgive their sin, and if not, please blot me out from your book which you have written.'" Now, the fact that Moses said to the people, said, "You've committed a great sin," shows that some of the transgressors had not been killed by the Levites. The Levites killed 3,000. I would suspect that they killed the people that were mostly in charge of it, but all the people sinned because they all went after those idols. But maybe the Levites killed the people who were more closely involved with it. John Gill says the people here had good reason to be afraid, because they had seen that most of the deceased people had come from the tribe of Levi, which means that there was a lot more tribes that didn't have their fair share of executed ones, and so they knew that trouble was probably coming. And I think that maybe here that Moses is making atonement. He wants to pray the Lord and say, "Look, let's don't do any more executions. We've done enough of that." I mean, it could be the Levites were going to start out the next day and keep on killing. So Moses wants to make atonement for their sin. Notice that a sin offering is not going to do here. This is a big, big sin. No sacrifice is going to cover this great a sin. Not even killing 3,000 people is going to cover it. Got to have atonement. And again, atonement is the word that means reconciliation, appeasement of an angry God, or the covering of sin. Those concepts are in that phrase, atonement. So Moses returns. Then Moses returned to the Lord in verse 11. Verse 31. That means he climbed back up Mount Sinai again. He must have been the most in shape prophet Israel ever had. He climbed up and down that mountain so many times. Now Moses said, forgive them, God, but if not, you're going to not forgive them, then blot me out from your book. Now, what does that mean? Well, here's three options. Moses could be saying, blot me out from the book of life. In other words, kill me, God. If you're going to kill the rest of the people by not forgiving them, well, then kill me too. I don't want to go on. Or he could have said, just take me out of eternal life. Blot me out from the book of eternal life. Let me go to hell. Of course, they didn't have a good idea of hell back then, but let me not see you forever and ever in the eternal mansions, if you will, if you're going to kill these people. I don't even want to go to heaven. That's option number two. Option number three is blot me off the muster roll, or blot me off the register, or blot me out of the genealogies of the Jews that are going to go to the promised land. So Moses is saying, if you're going to kill them and they're not going to go to the promised land, then I'm not going to go to the promised land. Well, of all those three options, I believe that Moses is saying, kill me. Blot me out from the book of life, not eternal life, but physically take my life, because I don't want to live if these people are going to die in the wilderness here. It's too painful for me. I can't deal with it. He said the same thing, basically, in Numbers 11:15. So if you are going to deal thus with me, please kill me at once if I have found favor in your sight, and do not let me see my wretchedness. This is when the Israelites were griping because they had no meat. And Moses said, just kill me, God. I'm tired of dealing with these people. I think that's what Moses is talking about here. He's had it. He might be a little hyperbolic. You know, kill me. This is killing me. I don't know. If he said, blot me out of the book of life eternally, blot me out of eternal life, that had to be hyperbole, because it would be impossible for Moses to ask to go to hell for the Israelites. Kind of like Paul, when he said the same thing. I wish that I myself were cursed, separated from Christ for the sake of my brethren, my kinsmen according to the flesh. Well, as I could wish, it's not that he can do it. You obviously can't go to hell for somebody else. So that might be what Moses is doing. He might be just saying, let me go to hell if you're gonna kill the Israelites. That's how bad this is to me. Well, it could be. Or it could be, just keep me out of the promised land if you're not going to let these people go to the promised land. Blot me out of the genealogies of the Jews, the book of life. Well, I think he's saying, kill me. I think he's depressed. Just kill me, God. Get it over with if things are going to be this bad. Now, assuming that that's what Moses meant, his gracious offer to die for the people is refused. As the NIV Study Bible says, the person who sins is responsible for his own sin. Moses didn't sin. The people sinned. Moses can't die for somebody else's sin. Now, this phrase here in verse 33, whoever has sinned against me, I will blot him out of my book. It sounds like God's getting ready to wipe them out wholesale. But God didn't, in fact, blot them out. So why does he say he will blot them out? Whoever has sinned against me, I will blot him out of his book. Well, did they all sin, right? But he didn't blot them out. So what's going on here? Well, here is one way you can say it. This is my idea. He specifically answered Moses and said, look, Moses, you just asked to die, but look, it's whoever has sinned against me, I will blot him out of my book. Whoever has sinned against me, I will die, and you didn't sin against me. It's the Israelites' sin, not you, so don't worry, I'm not going to blot you out. That's still a little bit problematical, though, because he says, the person who has sinned against me, whoever has sinned against me, I will blot him out of my book, I'll take him out. But God didn't take him out. Well, Adam Clark's idea of blotting out refers to the blotting out of the roll of those who were to enter the promised land. And this actually was true for everybody who sinned, because not a blessed one of them made it to the promised land. I will blot him out of my book, whoever sinned against me. Well, everybody had sinned against him, and everybody failed to make it into the promised land, unless you were under 20 years old, of course. So maybe Clark's idea is the best here. Now, God says, verse 34, go now, Moses, lead the people where I told you. God is telling Moses to continue on. God will not exterminate the Israelites. So Moses got a prayer answered. One more example of mercy in the Old Testament. There's lots of it. God says, my angel shall go before you. I'm assuming that's the angel of Jehovah, Jesus. Nevertheless, in the day when I will punish them for their sin. Now, that punishment for their sin could be the wandering around in the wilderness for 40 years until that present generation became extinct. It could be, but I think the easiest thing to do is the sin is verse 35, the Lord smote the people because of what they did with the calf which Aaron had made. Now, the NASB has smote, but the Holman Christian Study Bible has the Lord inflicted a plague. The NIV has struck the people with a plague. I don't know why the NASB didn't put the plague in there. It just said God smote the people. Must be a translation issue. But the idolatry did not go unpunished. Ladies and gentlemen, on that unhappy note, we have now finished Exodus chapter 32. So now, in our next audio, we will go to Exodus 33, verses 1 through 23, and we will look at Moses and Yahweh at the tent of meeting. How God would come to Moses and Moses would talk to him face to face like a friend at the tent of meeting. I hope you stay tuned for that audio, and I hope you enjoyed this one.